The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 2 million Native Americans living in the United States endured the highest poverty rate of any racial group in the country. Add to that high suicide rates, pervasive problems with alcohol and drugs, rape, and child abuse, all of which are more severe among the half of the population who live on reservations. And you have a painfully obvious crisis among North American Natives. What's less obvious are solutions. Some point to broken treaties that should be honored, others toward racial stereotypes in American culture that ought to be banned. But Naomi Schaefer Riley says what Native Americans need are property rights. She's author of The New Trail of Tears, How Washington is Destroying American Indians, and wrote about property rights on reservations for The Atlantic. Naomi, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So if you could summarize the laws that govern property on Native American reservations here in the U.S., what's the sort of status quo?
Right. So I think a lot of people don't really understand what a reservation is. A reservation means that the land is held in trust by the federal government. The only other people, by the way, that we hold things legally in trust for are children or the mentally incompetent. So I think it's actually pretty shameful that in the 21st century, this is the way we're talking about Indian lands. But what that means, in effect, is that if one Indian wanted to sell land on a reservation to another one, they would first have to get the permission of a bureaucrat from the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington. But the problems actually go much beyond that. If you wanted to, as an American Indian, get a mortgage on a reservation and you went to a bank, they would not give you one because you don't have the underlying title to the land. They would have no collateral, and they would not be able to foreclose on the property if you did not pay. In addition to that, of course, many Americans use the capital that they get from their land in order to start small businesses. They take out second mortgages or home equity loans, and American Indians don't have that access to capital that the rest of us have.
So everyday Americans enjoy these rights withheld from Native Americans. Why? What or who governs these rights? Is it old treaties?
No, it's actually it's the reservation system that was set up. And unfortunately, I think what people fail to understand is while the reservation system was really set up as a way of pushing Indians out of the way and keeping sort of them in a controlled space while we pursued manifest destiny, now I think people have come to see reservations as almost a way of protecting Indians, as a way of ensuring that white people don't get their land, buy their land, or take their land from them. And we've kind of set it up as this idea that Indians on these reservations are living in some kind of, you know, socialist, environmentalist utopia that is kind of frozen in time. But during the interviews that I did across the country on different reservations, I found that, of course, this is not the way Indians want to live. They want the same freedoms the rest of us have.
Is that universal? I mean, I'm imagining that normalizing property rights could have a huge economic impact, but it would also remove the protections of setting aside land. You know, if land could be sold to non-natives, isn't there a risk of these areas being lost to tribes?
I think that, of course, one of the things you could do is you could sort of set aside these lands and say they will still be governed by the tribes. In the same way that if you, you know, had the city of Boston, one person sells land to somebody else in the city of Boston, it's still part of the city of Boston. It's just owned, that individual owns it differently. And it's part of a system of property rights that is enforced by the government. But the problem is that this system really assumes that what Indians want is maybe to be farmers. I mean, a lot of the pieces, tracts of land that are owned are even too small to do anything useful with. So if you're an American Indian and you want to start up, you want to start a store, or you want to pursue a career, you know, that might require you to have money to put toward education, you don't have access for any of these things. And the result on the reservations is that there is almost no property, there's almost no private sector. I visited one Indian reservation in Montana where the unemployment rate is 78%. A lot of people say, "Oh, you mean the employment rate?" No. I mean the unemployment rate. There are really no there's no private enterprise. All of the employment is done by the federal government or the tribal government, and people really can't pursue the things that they want to as individuals or as families.
Okay, so you mentioned the no right to buy, sell, have a mortgage. How about development projects? You just mentioned the Crow Reservation in Montana you visited, and there is government funding there for building a new veterans home. And, of course, casinos have changed the economy for many tribes.
So, right, there is government funding for projects, and it just takes years and years and years for anything to get done because of the vast bureaucracy. I visited what was going to be a 15-bed veterans home that was going to cost $15 million. I mean, this is how much money it has taken to get through all of the different bureaucracies. There are 9,000 staff members at the Bureau of Indian Affairs. That's one for approximately every 110 American Indians on a reservation. And the American Indians themselves, you know, they refer to the BIA as bossing Indians around. They would really like Washington's bureaucracy off their backs. In terms of development, of course, Indian lands, while maybe in the 19th century were thought of sometimes as useless because they didn't have the proper soil for farming or raising cattle, a lot of them are hugely valuable now because they're sitting on top of coal or oil or resources that could be used for fracking if they wanted to. But the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Environmental Protection Agency combined to make it much more difficult for Indians to develop their land than for white people to develop theirs just a few steps off the reservation. One of the legislators I talked to said, "We are the most overregulated race on earth."
I'm speaking with Naomi Schaefer Riley. She's written a book called The New Trail of Tears, and it's about how Washington policy affects and governs American Indians. We're speaking specifically about U.S. law, which holds property rights in trust for Native Americans, and she says it's contributing to the grinding poverty among Native people. So the Indians that you spoke to, what do they envision? Tourism, mining, how would they do it differently?
Well, I think that they would do different things. I mean, different tribes would do different things, and different individual Indians would do different things. You have to come to understand that there's regulation both on what the tribes can do with public lands, but also what individuals could do with their lands. So I spoke to one man who was trying to buy a small piece of land from one of his neighbors to graze a few cattle on, and he and his neighbor had agreed on a price. And someone from the Bureau of Indian Affairs came in and said, "No, you can't sell it for that price because that's not fair market value." Now, of course, fair market value is, of course, what someone will give you for the land. It's not an artificial number that Washington comes up with. So those are sort of the two things. But to get back to your question, you mentioned casinos earlier. So those are tribal enterprises. And, you know, we do have to keep in mind that the number of actually successful casinos that have produced significant revenue is relatively small. I mean, we see them in the Northeast, you know, places like Connecticut. But most of the casinos that are in existence are really these kind of small dinky affairs where there's no tourism. And so the only people who are actually at the casinos are reservation Indians themselves. So it's in that sense, it's not doing those tribes much good. But it's also actually had extremely harmful effects on some of the tribes that have even been successful. So I visited the Seneca Territory in upstate New York. Now, they've actually made $1 billion on their gaming revenues, both on their territory and at a casino in Buffalo as well. Unfortunately, the way that money gets distributed is in annuities. So when you turn 21 on the Seneca Reservation, on the Seneca Territory, someone sends you a check for more than $30,000. Now, up until that point, you've had a pretty dismal education because the schools that exist on the territory and just off the territory are pretty terrible. You may not have worked at all because the unemployment rate is so high. You've never saved or invested, and you have no idea what to do with this money. And many tribal officials acknowledge that a lot of it just gets spent on drugs and alcohol, sadly.
You just mentioned the school's inadequate education. Yet, looking at what you wrote about, $20,000 spent per pupil. Now, that's compared to a national average of $12,400. A lot of money, billions of dollars going into managing, subsidizing lives, subsidizing housing, subsidizing other economic developments, road maintenance, courts, agriculture, social services, health for Native American people here in the U.S. Why isn't it working?
Well, I think there are a number of different reasons. First of all, as I mentioned, you have just the vast bureaucracy that has overtaken this, and bureaucrats will always find something to do. They don't want to lose their jobs. And so one of the things that certainly happens is a lot of the money just ends up staying in Washington. The second problem is corruption. It's not true on every reservation, but certainly a lot of tribes suffer from this problem, and the money does not necessarily get to the people who need it. But then you just have the problem of government distribution of wealth. Like I said, there is no private sector. And so one of the results of that is that there's just an extraordinary amount of nepotism on these reservations. If you have a relative, an uncle, a cousin, perhaps, who's on the tribal council and you want to be the fourth grade teacher, it doesn't matter whether you're qualified or not. You have the connection, and you could be the fourth grade teacher. It similarly works the other way. If you, happen to have, a student who is related to someone powerful in the tribe, and that student hasn't shown up to, 6 months worth of eighth grade, that eighth grade teacher, and I've interviewed some of these people, will be forced sometimes to pass that child, even if they're totally unqualified to go to the next grade, simply because of that family connection. So you can see how it is kind of, no matter how much money you pour into the system, if you've undermined the quality controls that are there, then there's really no way of ensuring success. I mean, American Indians have a 50% high school graduation rate, and that number is even lower for American Indians who just live on the reservation.
It just sounds like dismal conditions here in the U.S. And in Canada, there has been a push for legislation called the First Nations Property Ownership Act. Now, this would give them the legal framework for individual members to access capital, land rights. It's been described as, taking the feds out of the equation. What chance does the legislation have of passing?
Well, I think it actually has a pretty good chance. Right now, it's been a little bit sidetracked by some other Canadian Supreme Court decisions on Native and land rights. But I think there's actually widespread support for it. And one of the advantages that the legislation has is that tribes could opt in or out of it. If they don't want these property rights and they feel that this might, cause them some kind of, overturning of traditions in some ways, they don't have to take advantage of it. But for the tribes, particularly those in British Columbia, which have a great deal of political power in Canada, they are really trying to figure out ways that they can offer, get their people the kinds of freedoms that other people have. I visited, the Kamloops Band, and it's such an interesting contrast. You have on two sides of the river. One is regular Canadian British Columbia land, and the other land is what's called reserve land. That's what they call reservations there. Mm-hmm. And on the reserve land, you see great poverty, but you also see a lot of what's revealing about the property rights problem. There are temporary structures that are there. A lot of the land that is most valuable is simply being occupied by trailer homes. It's very hard when you don't have property rights to put any long-term investment into an area.
How would you compare Canada's laws and the motivation of Native Americans here in the U.S.?
I think they have a greater amount of political power simply because of the way natives are distributed there, which is to say that in certain provinces, they're actually carrying quite a bit of political power because of their numbers. In America, you have a few states, places like South Dakota or Arizona, where there's a significant Native population, but those states are, of course, a couple among the 50 states. And so I think that balance of power, the power structure that you see in Canada is not the same as here. And they also have very different, they have different treaties and different Supreme Court laws about this. But, as odd as it seems and as perhaps offensive as it seems to some people, I think that we can all agree that the system we have in place is simply not working today. And it's really time to rethink the way we have tried to protect the rights of Indians because what we're doing is not working.
Naomi, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Naomi Schaefer Riley. She's author of a book called The New Trail of Tears, How Washington is Destroying American Indians. And she wrote about property rights on reservations for The Atlantic. You'll find a link to both at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When Caroline Nesbitt decided to start a theater company in Sandwich in 1999, she faced some resistance. People in town knew her as the woman who raised ponies and gave riding lessons. What they didn't know was that Nesbitt is also a professional actress. Now, 17 years later, Nesbitt's Advice to the Players Theater Company is an integral part of town life, with local actors and teens joining with professionals in Shakespeare production throughout the year. Sean Hurley has the story.
Before the first day of rehearsal at the Sandwich Fairground stage, property lawyer Chris Bolt changed his voicemail message.
I am in our Meredith office briefly this morning, but I'll then be in rehearsals for The Tempest all afternoon. I'm sorry I'm not able to take your call at this time.
I play the evil brother Antonio. I am the usurper. I am the snake. I'm the bad guy.
Hang cur! Hang you horse on insolent noisemaker! We are less afeard to be drowned than thou art!
It's been said before that there's not that much difference between the theater and the law. We each have our script, we each have our audience, you know, whether it's the judge or jury or a client or a zoning board of adjustment.
My riggers are on the sides, the captain's in the back, the bosun's right here.
Before the first day of rehearsal, Lily Cardaropoli spent the morning directing a group of 7-year-olds through a scene from The Tempest at the Advice to the Players theater camp.
Ready?
Bosun!
Here, master, what cheer?
Good, speak to the mariners.
Higher my heart, cheerily my heart. Yar, yar, taking the topsail.
Down with the topsail.
Lower, lower.
What you then?
Lost. Good job, guys.
Well, these kids won't be in the main stage show. They will get to watch it and watch their camp counselor perform.
I'll be playing Miranda in The Tempest. Miranda is Prospero's daughter. And she was just a child when she was taken to the island with her father after he was exiled.
Oh, I have suffered with those I saw suffer. A brave vessel who had no doubt some noble creature in her dashed all to pieces.
Before the first day of rehearsal, Kim Miller practiced her registers, singing opera in the car as she drove to the fairgrounds.
The brilliant thing about being in a car is nobody else can hear you, so you can be as loud as you want without people looking at you like you're a freak.
You taught me language. Am I profit on it, ease? I know how to curse.
So the character of Caliban is a demi-demon playing with physicality, so it's a lot of creeping around as well. I'm going to have thighs of steel by the end of this run.
On the morning of the first day of rehearsal, the director of the show, Andrew Cottespotti, chanted before his daily yoga routine.
We can't do special effects. Our ability to do great scene changes and even makeup and costumes, it's limited out here. We have limited means. And Shakespeare is very good for that because Shakespeare had very little in the way of special effects. You know, his lights were the sky just like ours are.
Everybody ready?
Ready!
Places! Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. This is my fake curtain speech. Without further ado, I very much hope that you enjoy Advice to the Players' production of The Tempest.
Before the first day of rehearsal, Caroline Nesbitt, who plays Gonzalo, spent time with her Connemara ponies.
Gonzalo is sort of an ancient counselor who was very close to Prospero, and when Prospero is usurped from his position, Gonzalo is the person that makes sure that all of his magic books make it into the leaky boat that carries them to this desolate island.
Now would I give 1,000 furlongs of sea for an acre of barren ground, long heath, brown firs, anything! The wills above be done, but I would fain die a dry death.
You think of the Tempest and you think of the big effects and stuff, but in fact, if you bring it back to kind of the bare bones and to human imagination, you unlock a whole world of text that is actually what creates the magic in the end, is the beautiful words.
Before the first day of rehearsal, the beautiful words were printed and bound for the 1,000th or millionth time. The 24 scripts sat in a stack by the door in the old barn building in Sandwich, the theater group calls home. For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New Hampshire's White Mountain Range is rugged country, and for a long time, it was man's country, a vast wilderness where hunters, trappers, and drovers roamed. An ongoing exhibit at the Museum of the White Mountains reveals that the region has also been a proving ground for women. Taking the Lead, Women and the White Mountains uncovers the lives of female pioneers who helped make the range more welcoming to visitors and help shape its development and preservation. Far from the judgmental eyes of society, women were inspired to explore their talents and curiosities and creativity in the whites.
Hello, Virginia.
How are you?
Marcia Schmidt-Blaine. Nice
to meet you. Very nice to meet you as well.
Good. I was telling you about the Weeks Act.
Last week, producer Jimmy Gutierrez and I got a tour with the show's co-curator, Dr. Marcia Schmidt-Blaine. She's also the museum's interim director and professor of history at Plymouth State. Like its subject, the show is unconventional, inviting visitors to pick up and look at stereoscopic photos, touch the artifacts and notebooks, and even the clothes.
So this costume is portraying Lucy Crawford around 1825. She came up here earlier to help her grandfather, who died shortly thereafter. The grandfather said, "You need to marry your cousin, Ethan Allen." They did. And they proceeded to have a number of children.
Ten.
But the first day that she had her first child, her entire house burned down around her. And Ethan was not at home. This amazingly strong woman is trying to save things, not just her baby, at the same time. This is one of the ways you get an idea of the strength of the women. Mm. The other thing that Lucy was really good at is noticing things. So she would keep notes on what was happening, and in the 1840s wrote the first history of the White Mountains. We have a copy of it as well.
A woman wrote the first history of the mountains.
In her husband's name. The I there is Ethan Allen, but it's not Ethan Allen. Mm. It's Lucy. And she tells a lot of stories about women that I think would have been lost otherwise.
One story that Lucy witnessed was the arrival in 1821 of three sisters from Portsmouth, Eliza, Abigail, and Harriet Austin, who were determined to hike the mountain. Lucy, however, stayed behind.
Ethan Allen told her, "You're not going to hike. You're going to stay here where a woman belongs. So you can look out and see the beautiful mountains, but no. You belong at home with the kids. You're staying here."
We walk past a window and a partition at the exhibit that opens to a wall of landscapes, reinforcing the sense of confined detachment that many women felt in the whites. Marcia shows us a painting of the Austin sisters, and how perfect, by the way, that they're named Austin, after they arrived at the Summit House on Mount Washington. The picture is attributed to Charles Codman.
The other thing to note, too, is these three women did not just start at the base of Mount Washington, hike to the top, hike to the bottom, go home. This was several days and nights out in the wilds. Now think about how different that would be. In the 19th century, very few men did that, much less women. Camping was not a thing. You did not go camping. And women certainly did not sleep with strange men.
Not all pioneering women left images or books behind, and not all were tourists. Here from author Elizabeth Yates is a summary of what early settler women faced. Life was hardest on the women, hungering for someone to talk with, longing for the sight of another woman. She might lift her eyes to the mountains she saw from the small panes of her windows and wonder what lay beyond them, blue and beautiful as they may be, outlined sharply against the sky. They were the unassailable wall. On the other side of them was the unknown. On her side, what had been and would always be.
What was she saying about how women lived on the mountain then?
She was essentially saying that women were trapped. They could go around their house and they could not go beyond that dooryard area and their house, that this was their domain, and outside that it was men's domain.
So given that they had that confined relationship, it is very interesting that so many of them began to advocate for development of trails and development of hospitality, places where people could stay along the mountain. Mm-hmm. What do you think it was about?
I think we're looking at a group of leaders, a group of women who were not necessarily ones who fit into the urban area, even if they lived in urban areas, women were who were willing to take risks and happily so. Some good examples, these two women over here.
We walk past sketchbooks and watercolors of native plants made by women painters and botanists. I was surprised to learn that Mount Hayes, Larcom Mountain, and several trails and campgrounds were named after women, and that women organized efforts to raise money to purchase essential tracts like Franconia Notch as protected parkland. Women worked in the huts when men were called away during the wars. They were literally trailblazers, like the poet and botanist Lucia Cook Pachowska and her daughter, Marian Pachowska, who created one of the earliest sketch maps of the Northern Presidential Range.
And these two women were from New Jersey, and they formed a friendship with a woman named Isabella Stone. And the three of them wrote back and forth. They also wrote a series of articles in Appalachia. I mean, they were very, very active. And they hiked. They were amazing hikers. Lucia apparently painted quite a bit. They were very well respected in the Appalachian Mountain Club. They also were instrumental in figuring out where trails should be and helping to make trails. These women were not the norm. Actually, it's one of the things that I thought was really interesting about looking at the White Mountains and women, is that a lot of the women who come to the White Mountains end up leaving with this sense of empowerment, of the leadership abilities that they hadn't even thought they had. And they may not even call themselves leaders, but are clearly ahead of their time.
You said they wouldn't have called themselves leaders necessarily. But do you think that they were, you know, those three women, the three Austin sisters, were they climbing the mountain or setting out to climb Mount Washington because they wanted to be the first women?
For these women, no. They were much more interested in discovery and in finding out something for themselves and then sharing it, which they did again and again and again. These three women were just amazing women, and we would not know a thing about them except that they wrote letters. Those letters were saved. They were eventually sold at auction. There are lots of good sources.
How about those people who were maintaining the huts in the woods? You know, those early pioneers in the work of the Appalachian Mountain Club, the hut system, the trail maintenance crews. Mm-hmm. A lot of them, men, obviously. How were they about sort of sharing the mountain space with women?
How to approach this delicately? Not very good. Actually, I was talking to a huts member who was a hutsman before there were women. He said it was a little bit like a college men's club, and we actually sometimes kind of resented the visitors coming through. Another woman said that one thing she was told was that the clubs at the huts were much more civilized once women came in, and they didn't mind bringing their children to the huts. And I thought, oh, well, that says a lot right there, doesn't it? So there were definitely some changes. But, I mean, again, we're talking the 1970s, before women were accepted as full huts members.
I thought I had read something about a little bit more severe reaction than we don't really like the ladies in the huts.
You had. There are quite a few. And there's some reactions from the women. There's one where a young woman wrote, "Wake up, huts committee," essentially saying, "We're not just here for making babies and cooking meals. We can do everything the men can in the huts."
You're listening to my visit to the Museum of the White Mountains to see Taking the Lead, Women and the White Mountains. Dr. Marcia Schmidt-Blaine guided us around. She's co-curator of the exhibit, along with Cynthia Robinson. I want to go back to this dress, touching it, we should note, because we can. But I can't help looking under the skirt. This is a lot of fabric. We've got bloomers, a sort of petticoat, another layer.
never mind her husband saying that women were not suitable. The clothing was not suitable for
climbing. Clothing was not suitable at all. And of course, they were wearing corsets as well. So even if you're wearing a lesser corset, it is still stiff and breathing is difficult. I can't imagine even thinking about hiking in these type of clothes. And yet they did. I mean, we forget this was the norm. This is how women dressed.
When did that begin to shift? When did women start advocating for...
Well, advocation had started long before. I mean, you can go back to the 18th century and women are advocating this. But in the 19th century, you do get those leaders who are out there saying, you know, forget the corsets, let's wear bloomers, let's at least shorten the skirts. We forget that they were hiking in areas where there weren't trails.
Oh, right.
So what's the best way to dress? And they wrote a series of articles, a number of women wrote about what's the best way to dress, what's the best fabric to wear, if you get completely wet, as they often did, crossing streams. What's the best thing to wear so you can dry out? What should you do with your feet, etc.?
How about women who were not just the casual hikers, but the real mountaineers? Yeah. What are some examples of women who were, you know, scaling rock faces and that kind of thing?
Well, let's go look at some of the scaling rock faces people.
Yes. We walk past a mannequin dressed in a reproduction of a much more comfortable-looking hiking costume from 1915, a jacket and knickers made of heavy gray wool, and came upon a photograph from 1929 of an absolutely striking woman wedged and holding herself up with one knee and one foot between two giant rocks.
So one woman that you absolutely need to know about is Miriam Underhill. She became Miriam Underhill O'Brien and is very well known in the Randolph area. In 1925, Miriam and her brother and some friends were out in the White Mountains, and one of her brother's friends got lost. And so they all went out in the middle of the night looking for this young man. They found him, but in doing that, she discovered that she didn't just like the mountains. She loved the mountains. She felt at home in the mountains. This is where she was meant to be. So she started hiking more and discovered climbing. Now, her family introduced her to climbing. If you look at this picture, you'll see a young woman who's in essentially dungarees and a shirt and a scarf around her head and a rope tied around her underarms going up above her. I mean, anybody who climbs now would
like
be overwhelmed.
It's like a shoulder dislocator.
Oh, it hurts to look at. It truly does. She became one of the most skilled technical climbers in the United States. She went over to the Alps and wanted to hike and climb in the Alps, but every time she'd climb, these men kept taking the lead and she wasn't able to do anything about it. So even when she was ostensibly the lead, some man would say, oh, there's a problem, I'll step in. And she would be really not happy about that. So she found another woman who said, I'm not either. And they decided to try manless climbing. Manless climbing, I love it. So the first major mountain they took on was the Grappon. And they climbed the Grappon. It took several days. They got to the top, got proof that they were there, came down, and they announced at the bottom, we have climbed the Grappon. So a French guide, and usually men and women were, you know, hired guides to get to the top of the mountains. That evening, as they're all sitting around, this French guide announces, the Grappon is no more. It's been conquered by women.
Why go up?
Absolutely. So she climbed. She ended up marrying Mr. Underhill. And the two of them climbed all over the United States, all over the Alps. They came back, as I mentioned, and stayed in Randolph. They were members, some of the first members of the 4,000 Footer Club, and they were some of the first ones to climb all the 4,000 footers in the winter.
Okay, Marcia, clearly in me, you have an adoring audience. You know, I love women's history. Mm-hmm. It's so fascinating for me to hear about how the roles have shifted. But how about for other people who think, oh, I don't look at the mountains as a gendered place. Why is this interesting to them?
Mm-hmm. In part because they can see themselves in the mountains. Male, female, child, adult, young, old. I think you can come in here and you can begin to say, oh, these women faced one obstacle after another. I face obstacles as well. What can the mountains give to me as well? So seeing the mountains play out in your own space and in your own roles is exactly what we're hoping people will get out of this. Also, we're hoping that when they come out, they'll also come out with a creative view of the mountains. They can begin to think about the mountains from an artistic point of view, from a scientific point of view, from a historical point of view, from a writing point of view, a literary point of view, all of those views, and seeing the mountains more holistically, which is exactly what we at Plymouth State really push.
Thank you so much for showing us around.
You're welcome.
Even though I brought a token mail.
We're always happy to have them.
Our guide was Dr. Marcia Schmidt-Blaine, Interim Executive Director of the Museum of the White Mountains and co-curator with Cynthia Robinson of Taking the Lead, Women and the White Mountains. The show is on view until October 7th, so you can go see it when the fall foliage is in full effect. We've got a gallery of images and more information on these incredible women of the White Mountains, past and present, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott with a new 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. Today, Chuck Klosterman. He writes essays and novels and is a genuinely original voice. He's been a columnist, sports writer, the ethicist for the New York Times Magazine, and author of several bestsellers, including Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs. Maybe you heard our interview with him about his new book, But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. I started off with our icebreaker. Which is hardest for you to write? The first sentence or the last?
The last sentence is more difficult because in all likelihood, the first sentence is something that was kind of built into your mind before you even realized you were going to write the book. In a way, you knew what the book was going to be about in sort of an ideological form, and there might be some clear entry to that, and it just seems like the first sentence comes relatively easy. The last sentence is tough because you have to give the person reading the book a sense that this is the logical place for the book to conclude. I guess part of the reason maybe it seems so obvious to me that it's the first sentence is because I think I've written the first sentence to about 500 books, but I've only written the last sentence to 9 of them.
Do you edit as you go along or do you wait until the end? You know, get it out there and then edit.
I edit as I go.
Why?
Edit each sentence as I do it. I don't know. This is a weird answer, but I think it's purely an extension of technology. I think that if I was using a typewriter, I would write the whole thing straight through and then I would go back and make edits. But now I edit each sentence as I write it. Of course, I edit again at the end. But when I finish the first draft of a book, it is relatively close to the book that gets published, but that's partially due to the fact that even in the first draft, I've written every sentence 3 times. I mean, I almost do it automatically without thinking. I'll type a sentence, and as I'm typing it, I'll suddenly find myself hitting the delete button and moving back 15 characters and writing again. It's almost mechanical or machine-like, but that's how I do it.
Are there habits that you've picked up that you'd encourage other writers to take up or maybe even avoid in order to be better, more productive writers?
I would say the best advice that I ever came across, and I think this is weirdly credited to Ernest Hemingway. I didn't realize that till 10 years after someone else had told me, but it really helps to stop writing at a point where you know what you're going to write next. The first sentence of a book maybe is very, you know, reasonable to write, but the first sentence of the 8th chapter can be really difficult. So it really helps to say, stop writing when you got 500 words left of chapter 7. And you know that when you get there the next day or the next morning or whatever and start writing, you at least know what those 500 words are going to be. And you kind of create this illusion of momentum.
What do you think is the most common mistake that new writers make?
The most common mistake that new writers make, I think, probably is not putting themselves in a position where you can write badly for a while. I mean, I think because of the internet now, it is too easy to have your writing consumed by other people at a stage when it doesn't really reflect the writer you want to be. This is like bad for 2 reasons. One, people can criticize it in a way that may stop you from being and becoming who you want to be. But I think just as damaging is people can support certain things that you're doing because it matches their biases or they find it amusing or whatever. And it's impossible not to hear that feedback and think, well, this is what I should be doing. And then you end up becoming just sort of like a caricature of the one thing you did that somebody else liked.
Hmm. How about for you? What's your worst distraction from getting work done?
I have a friend who's a writer, and he told me that the biggest distraction is that his writing machine is also his pornography delivery machine. I thought that was a really hilarious, insightful thing. For me, it's more like I'm distracted by my own laziness. I get, like, that sometimes I just feel tired, and I think to myself, well, maybe if I lay down, I won't be as tired, and then I'll write. Anytime you do that, it's over. I have never in my life laid down and then got up again and wrote. I just started watching TV.
Well, that makes me feel better, right? Because I often get the same temptation. But do you just press through the tiredness? Because you know this is an old habit. This is an old trigger.
Well, this might sound arrogant, but I will say one thing that I like about myself is I am a pretty disciplined writer. I can make myself do it every day. I think because, you know, my dad was a farmer and my brothers were all farmers. And to me, a bad writing day is still better than that. I always feel as though I gotta write so I can keep doing this as a living because it's better than a job.
What's your best environment for writing?
I only like writing in my office in the dark.
Oh, really? In the dark? So not a cafe, not a plane, not any of those things?
Now, I don't get that, why people go to cafes to write. That makes no sense to me. How is it more beneficial to put yourself in a situation where it's, like, consciously more annoying? I mean, to have people around you, people buying things, glasses clinking. I never have understood that. I mean, to me, you always are trying to get away from the world. That's what writing is, right? Getting away from the world. So I don't want to put myself into the world to do it.
Are there any, you know, tools, books that you would recommend for an aspiring writer to help them along?
Cocaine. No, that's I'm totally joking. That's a terrible idea. That's a terrible idea.
It's worked tools, for some.
Yeah, at first. it works for lots of people
at first.
Yeah, and then at the end, it's like, well, I'm a cocaine user who also writes or whatever. I would say tools. You know, not really. I think the more accoutrements you add, the more risk you create for the possibility that you won't be able to work if it's not there. Hmm. You know what I'm saying, in a way? It's like, why would you want to add something to the process that if it disappears, you'll miss it? I mean, it's sort of like, you know, giving your kid a blanket, it calms him down as long as he has that blanket. At some point he's not, and then he's going to lose his mind. So I like to be bare bones.
Any other fantasy dream job you have besides writer?
A private investigator.
Really?
It would be like being a reporter, but you'd never have to write the story. I think that would be the greatest thing. Plus, I'm just a naturally nosy, gossipy person. Like, the idea of staking out a house, that seems great to me. Just sitting in a car and watching a window, I would love to do that.
Chuck Klosterman, thank you so much for speaking with
us. Thanks.
Chuck Klosterman there, essayist, novelist, columnist, farmer's son, and author most recently of But What If We're Wrong, based on the perfectly Klosterian notion that it is impossible to understand the world of today until today has become tomorrow. Well, I'll just leave you with that. The 10-Minute Writers Workshop is a production of NHPR, produced by Sarah Plourd with help this week from Taylor Quimby. And a quick note before we go, ever wonder why people pay good money to climb ropes, crawl through muddy obstacles, and be electrocuted? Is it a cult? An echo of our cave people bodies rebelling against cubicle culture? Well, a new film called The Rise of the Sufferfest tries to get at why 500,000 people do obstacle course races like Tough Mudder, the Spartan Race, and countless others. It's the fastest growing sport in the world. We'll speak with the director of the film next week, but it is showing at the Capitol Center for the Arts in Concord on Friday. I'm Virginia Prescott, a big fan of the Pleasant Fest. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.